your side of the laundry pile. She might tell Pivel something about it. She sat listening to the people around her through the walls of the hotel room, wondering if any of them were having sex right now. Growing up, she had heard women moaning in what seemed like a combination of pain and pleasure. She had lived in a small apartment building, where the paper-thin walls left little of their neighbors' sexual relations to the imagination. She herself had never uttered more than a squeak or two of pain when Rom had visited her room on those rare occasions. Sometimes she wondered how she ever had gotten pregnant. He came to her so infrequently. Unable to sleep or even rest, with the lights outside and the buzzing in her own head, Pivel turned once again to her itinerary, as though it were some kind of holy text. She had practiced saying each city on the map she had been given, rolling the letters of each name in her mouth like fennel seeds, splitting them with her teeth and swallowing them down to try to absorb them, to be prepared. What would they be like, these American cities? What would she find in them that Rahi had left behind? She wasn't sure where he had visited or what he had seen during his time in America. Perhaps she would be walking the streets he had walked, or perhaps she was searching in vain. Perhaps he really was dead, or perhaps he would be there in the end, waiting for her, and he would leave the strange man who had enslaved him with desire and run away with her. Her son would be 30 now. She had been 30 the year that she had had him. So late. So many people thought she would never have a baby, had wondered what curse the Senguptas had taken on, that the greatness of Ram Sengupta wouldn't be passed along to the next generation. And then there he was. Rahi. Their gift. Pivel put away her itinerary and turned off her lamp. The curtains tried their best, but light still poured through the edges of them, spilling around the cracks. She lay in the blinking, low, colorful room and waited for the morning to come. Chapter 18. After Beam came out to his parents, Jake had assumed that his rules about public behavior would shift a bit, but if anything, they grew worse. This confused Jake, but when he asked Beam about it, he would simply say it was how he had been raised, that it would have been the same with a woman. Jake did not believe this, but as he had no evidence to the contrary, he had to take it as truth. Privately, he thought that Beam was determined to live in a way his parents would approve of, despite the fact that they would never know it. For Beam, this was his only connection to his family, but for Jake, it was a new rejection every day. Indoors, in his comfortable apartment or Beam's tiny rooms in Berkeley, Beam would cling to him with desperation. But out on the street, they were friends, nothing more. Beam would try clumsily, laughing at himself, telling jokes, attempting to make it funny. And Jake would laugh when he could. But most of Beam's attempts just made him sad. Beam called himself the Ice Queen, which he thought was unbearably clever. He performed exaggerated flinches when Jake tried to touch him and pounced on Jake when they came home, desperately trying to make up for his public deficits with private affection. Jake wanted to respect Beam's needs, but he hated that the person he loved, the person who loved him, refused to touch him in front of other people. It made Jake feel cold, and he found himself smiling brightly at passers-by and waiters, craving the public display of affection that Beam refused to give him. Beam sensed his hurt once as they sat together in a darkened movie theater, and he carefully put his hand on Jake's knee when the lights went down, after looking around to make sure no one could see. Jake was disgusted. Beam was placating him with a half-hearted grope in a darkened theater as if they were teenagers. He shook off Beam's hand and angrily stormed out of the theater, not caring about the scene he was making, wanting to be far away. He looked back once. Beam was still staring at the screen, trying to look normal. Jake wanted to scream. Jake did not smoke. He knew it was bad for him, and besides, it was criminally expensive, and he hated the smell that clung to his hands and his hair. He would proudly tell anyone he met that he was a non-smoker. But when he felt anything so deeply that it hurt, the only cure for him would be a cigarette. The numbing feeling of the nicotine and the slight lightheadedness it caused calmed him and made him feel balanced. He had tried to break this rare habit many times, but he could not. Instead, he would, when very upset, buy a pack of cigarettes and allow himself a single one, and then leave the packet and matches out for a homeless person to find. Beam caught up to him just as he was inhaling the last puff of a burned-down cigarette. Beam's eyes widened, and Jake realized Beam had never seen him smoke before. Beam sat down next to him on the pavement and reached for the pack, taking a cigarette for himself and lighting it up with matches taken from Jake's limp fingers.
"I've never seen you smoke before," Jake said.
"I'm sorry," Beam said.
"Why?"
Jake was curious. Would Beam be sorry for the right thing?
"For the way I am,"
Beam said it simply, shrugging. Jake looked at him.
"I love who you are,"
Jake said, his voice cracking slightly. Beam smiled again sadly.
"I was not raised watching people touch. I was not raised watching men love each other. Some things are for public, and some things aren't. My parents..." "I don't want to hear about your parents," Jake said calmly. "They are not here. I am."
Beam looked at him, his eyes dark and glistening with tears.
"I know."
And then he began to cry in earnest, finally unrestrained in a public space. Jake held him. Beam was stiff in Jake's arms, but Jake didn't care. It was better than nothing. Jake knew that Beam might never be as physical as he wanted him to be, but something had shifted, and he knew that the charade of public denial was done. Perhaps this had been how Beam mourned, and after the mourning was the moving on. Jake lay in bed that night, watching Beam, who was a deeper sleeper, snore, and wondered if he could stand to be with someone who might never be okay with his own life, who would always feel that what they were doing and what they wanted from each other was wrong. He loved Beam completely, with a force that often terrified him, but he also loved himself. How long could both loves survive? Jake closed his eyes, but all he could think about was smoking a cigarette. Chapter 19. Although it was unusual for him, Ronnie had decided that he would accompany Satya and Rebecca on their first day with Mrs. Sengupta. As it was Satya's first tour and Rebecca's first experience with the company, he told himself that he was being a responsible boss, but in reality he was excited to be back on the Circle Line. It was the one tourist activity he actually enjoyed. Looking at himself in the bathroom that morning, he giggled in anticipation as he combed his thinning hair. It was 6:30, but he had to leave soon if he was to be there at 8:45, his customary 15 minutes early for clients. Getting out of the train, Ronnie followed a slim but round pair of buttocks up the subway stairs and out into the sea of people that was Times Square. He liked following women up the stairs, especially when the weather was nice and their bodies weren't restricted by bulky coats. He enjoyed the denim-clad view for a full 2 minutes, before realizing that the person he was following was none other than his newest employee, Rebecca. She struggled to roll her two suitcases down the crowded sidewalks of Times Square, and Ronnie rushed up to help her, almost receiving a smack in the face with her purse as thanks for his pains.
"Mr. Munshi! I'm so sorry. I thought someone was trying to steal my stuff."
Ronnie reeled back, hurt. He recovered quickly.
"You're right on time, I see," he said approvingly.
Rebecca knew she was in fact early, but she felt it wise not to argue the point. Instead, she smiled and nodded.
"I like to be prompt. Is Satya with you?"
Ronnie shook his head. They arrived at the hotel and stepped into the lobby. Ronnie didn't see Satya anywhere. He had repeated his injunction that the guide be early at least 5 times when they had spoken the previous day, and he had also mentioned that he himself would be accompanying them on their first day of excursions, which should have been an indicator that the boy should be on his best behavior. As he looked around the lobby, there was no sign of Satya, no one who appeared to be remotely Bangladeshi, just a few Mexican people cleaning. "I know it's too early for me to check in, but do you have a place where I can store my luggage?" Ronnie opened his mouth to respond, but realized that Rebecca was talking to the person at reception who helped her lock up her bags and place them in their luggage room. Ronnie checked his watch. It was 8:50. By his calculations, Mrs. Sengupta would have finished her breakfast by now and was presumably checking on her appearance before making her first entrance in front of her awaiting audience. For all their claims to modesty and simplicity, he found these Indian aunties by and large to be a vain lot, always conscious of their need to make an entrance, of their gold jewelry and their fine purses, and he felt it part of his job to accommodate them, exclaiming over their smooth skin and dark hair, which he knew owed more to dye than to youth. "Mr. Munshi?" A quiet voice behind them made both Rebecca and Ronnie turn, catching their first glimpse of Mrs. Sengupta, the plainly dressed Indian woman in a simple white sari. No jewelry and no makeup surprised Ronnie, but he had no time to register his surprise, because he was too upset that Satya himself had yet to appear. It was unconscionable for the guest to have arrived before the guide. If he could, he would have wanted to give the impression that Satya had been waiting in the lobby since the previous evening, standing at attention in anticipation of Mrs. Sengupta's every whim. This was not a good start. Not a good start at all. Ronnie fumed internally, while presenting Mrs. Sengupta with a slightly oily smile and bending over to touch her feet respectfully. He then stepped back, indicating Rebecca as if he were a game show host.
"Your companion."
"Hello, I'm Rebecca Elliott. It's very nice to meet you, Mrs. Sengupta," Rebecca said, formally but with a nice degree of warmth. She held out her hand to be shaken. Mrs. Sengupta seemed surprised, but happy. She opened her mouth to reply, but was cut off by Ronnie.
"Greetings, distinguished auntie and wonderful madam, and welcome yourself to America. I trust you have had a night of extreme comfort and luxury here in the heart and center of the great city of New York, the biggest of apples, though I, of course, prefer the highly superior Alfonso Mango. I am Ronnie Munshi. You are recognizing my voice from the phone, I am sure and certain. Guide has been delayed by life-threatening illness. Very serious, but I am sure completely fine very soon. So we will start the tour together, as of course planned, in approximately and exactly 4 minutes, which should give you this time to use the WC, as it is called. Water closet, or loo, of course, should you need to do so at any time in this time. Guide will of course be here quite soon, but in the meantime you will be pleased to accept personal attention from myself."
"But the guide is here, Mr. Munshi." Mrs. Sengupta's voice was as soft in person as it had been on the phone. Ronnie and Rebecca had to lean forward a bit to hear her, which made the woman shrink back.
"What is this, madam?"
Ronnie looked around for Satya again, wondering if Mrs. Sengupta was one of those spiritualists who had been speaking in a religious sense, that is, the presence of all people was always around and that sort of nonsense. Ronnie hated that kind of thinking, but he would adapt, of course, to the needs of his client. And perhaps they could stop by a psychic reading along the way to the boat, or after, really, because of the timing.
"Here it is, Mrs. Sengupta."
Satya ran up and handed Mrs. Sengupta a purse.
"I forgot my purse in the breakfast room. Mr. Roy very kindly went back to get it for me. He arrived here at 8 and accompanied me at breakfast. He doesn't look sick, Mr. Munshi."
Ronnie's face reddened to the shade of a ripe cherry at Mrs. Sengupta's faintly curious tone. She didn't appear to be mocking him, but Ronnie wasn't sure. He had to regain control of the situation, fast.
No. Yes. No. Not him. Another guide. I am very sorry. All apologies. Forgot which one I was speaking to. Business is doing so well. I have too many guides now. All apologies.
Rani glared at Satya. A full hour early? He would have admired it if it hadn't been so presumptuous.
Shall we go then?
Mrs. Sengupta inquired.
Rani nodded, all smiles.
Your adventure awaits.
Mrs. Sengupta paused as she passed Rani, making sure Satya was well on his way out.
He doesn't look sick at all, Mr. Munshi. He doesn't look Indian, either.
This was not a good start. The boat ride, which he had been anticipating with such joy, now seemed like a prison sentence. He would remind Satya to be as Indian as possible when he got a moment alone with him, and reprimand him for this one-hour early trick. And, he thought, make it mandatory for all his guides from now on.
Looking out over the side of the boat onto the rippling waters of the Hudson River, Satya felt his insides twist like candy floss. He hadn't been on many boats in his life, and something about watching the Circle Line boat, a large, ungainly thing slugging through the dark, oily water, made him feel dizzy. He had been early to pick up Mrs. Sengupta, as instructed over and over again by his employer. He had been polite and watched his Bengali diction carefully, trying to smoothly erase any geographical markers from his inflection and accent. He had bowed, touched her feet, explained that he was honored, debased himself completely in deference to her age and social status. In short, he did everything Rani had ever told him to do and then some. But Boss was refusing to look at him now. And though he was jovial and enthusiastic, this was, to Satya's eye, for Mrs. Sengupta's benefit.
Boats leave right on time here, you see, madam? Neither too early nor too late. It is an excellent rule for life as well, is it not, Satya?
Rani's voice had a strange edge as he continued speaking.
Too early can be as bad as too late, can it not, madam?
Can it, Mr. Munshi? How?
The widow's calm response stumped Rani, who opened his mouth like a fish and sputtered, gasping for air.
Well, it is an obvious fact, isn't it?
Not at all,
Rebecca broke in. Satya didn't know what was happening, but he resented Rebecca's intrusion. Rebecca shrank under Rani and Satya's dark looks, but she kept her eyes on them, unblinking. The staring contest seemed to progress for ages until Rani finally pretended that some spot of water from the ocean had irritated his eye, and he ducked his head.
People can die too soon. Mrs. Sengupta pronounced this as calmly as if she were stating the price of onions. Everything froze, and exactly 10 seconds after she had said it, Rani began nodding his head, smiling, frowning, almost crying, apologizing for her recent loss with a fervor that amazed Rebecca, Satya could see. He himself was so used to this sort of thing from his boss, but he always enjoyed the performance. Rani took on the mantle of mourning this stranger as if he were Rani's own father, praying to Mrs. Sengupta's husband, asking for his blessing. Satya looked around and saw Rebecca's eyes, round and yet somehow skeptical, and despite his own understanding of the doubt in her gaze, he felt the need to defend his boss, and so he joined in, sobbing and sighing for a man he would never know. Really, he should thank the man he knew for allowing the widow her trip, which let him be her guide. Still, he felt a loyalty to Rani, so he moaned and groaned along with him as the widow watched, her face a blank slate. Isn't that nice?
It was Rebecca's voice again, and Satya cracked open one eye, ready to scream at her for her lack of proper respect for the important mourning rituals of the widow's world. When he realized that she was pointing out Ellis Island, an important site on the tour and a vital part of understanding America, which was one of Rani's major points of guiding. Have fun, stay safe, buy gifts, and understand America. Satya realized he was falling behind in his guiding duties,
and rushed to catch up.
It's where people used to have to stop and be examined before they entered the USA, Satya remarked helpfully.
Yes, I know. My grandparents came through there. Rebecca said the words absently, but they left Satya amazed. This was something he had read about. To meet someone who actually had been a part of this was astounding. Bangladesh only dated back to 1971. Rebecca's family had come to Ellis Island before his country had even existed. They used to change people's names, Rebecca explained, to make them more American. You would come in a Scarola and leave a Smith.
Just like that?
Rebecca nodded. Satya gritted his teeth.
He should have been explaining that fact, and if he had known it, he would have.
But the widow seemed interested.
Do they still do that?
I don't think so. Not if the immigrants don't want to, Rebecca replied. The widow nodded and looked at the island until it was too far behind them to see. After Ellis Island floated away into the distance, the group quieted, each retreating to their thoughts as the boat guide droned on endlessly about the 9/11 memorial and why New Jersey wasn't as bad as people might think. As the tour continued, Satya observed his little group from the corner of his eye as he breathed deeply to calm his churning stomach. The day was cool and mildly drizzling, but Mrs. Sengupta didn't seem to mind. She sat with a scarf around her head, observing the cityscape as it slowly drifted past. Unlike so many of the tourists on the boat, she didn't take a single photo. Her abstinence was more than compensated for by the small Japanese tour group sitting in front of her, who hadn't stopped recording the journey with phones and video cameras since the moment they stepped onto the boat. They weren't alone. Everyone on board was obsessed with documentation except them. Teenagers took selfies, constantly comparing them, while a couple had a friend take endless photos of the two of them, the girl's large engagement ring prominently displayed. Even Ronnie had snapped a few shots. Sitting beside Satya, Rebecca read from a tour book. This surprised Satya. She had lived in New York for a long time. Why would she need a book about it? But she was absorbed, ducking her head over the pages to protect them from the moisture in the air. Satya hoped she didn't have aspirations of guiding the tour herself. With Boss being as oddly angry as he was, she might supplant Satya, and then where would he be? Satya yawned deeply. He hadn't been able to sleep the night before. He was nervous about guiding, and it felt strange to be leaving New York without knowing where Ravi was. What if Mrs. Hafiz sent him another letter? He had stopped by his first apartment just to check, but there had been neither mail nor news of his friend. When he wrote to her, he had sent a new address, but the letter had gone out only the day before. It would take weeks to arrive and weeks for a return letter, if there even was one. And Ravi was nowhere to be found, although Satya had pretended in the letter that they had been together. By the time the lie reached Mrs. Hafiz, he hoped it would be true. As the ship plowed through the waters, it reminded him of the trip over, of watching the ocean with Ravi and looking for fish in the grimy depths. He felt suddenly fragile as the boat listed heavily in the water and grew even dizzier, almost faint. Satya scowled at his physical weakness. He knew he had been the one in the wrong, stealing something that wasn't his. But wasn't that what they had always done? When they were children, they had had a tradition of stealing the food off each other's plates. And then there had been the real things, the actual thefts. The money stolen from Satya's grandmother to pay for Ravi's fancy sneakers, leaving the Roys without milk for the whole month, or the pilfering of one of Ravi's mother's bangles to pawn in exchange for movie money. Theirs had been a friendship based on robbery, running out of food stalls together to avoid paying for steaming plates of fish curry and rice, or stealing girls' underwear off the washing lines to sniff them in their beds at night. Was this so different? The boat guide on the loudspeaker tore through his reverie, alerting the passengers for the 10th time at least to the 9/11 memorial.
which was, at this point, approximately 1.5 miles away. Satya frowned, wondering if this man was so adamant because he saw a small group of brown people on board. Looking around, he saw Rebecca rolling her eyes, and Mrs. Sengupta looking confused. Only Ronnie seemed happy about the constant repetition of the information, smiling and nodding as if this man was doing a magnificent job, giving constant updates as to their proximity to the site of the tragedy.
Never, 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 never forget. If you haven't been, as soon as you leave this boat today, I want you to make your way down there. It's just a short 5-block and 2-avenue walk to the train, right there at Times Square, yes, with the lights. And then you just take the E train right on down. Discounts are available at our Circle Line ticket booths, but really, for something like this, can't you splurge? September 11th. If you remember nothing else in your life, remember that day.
Mrs. Sengupta was looking increasingly puzzled. Was the widow so out of touch? Even in Bangladesh, she had heard about the event, though admittedly some members of his class had cheered when they saw the news, thinking it was a publicity stunt for a movie. That had seemed very funny at the time, he remembered. Satya leaned forward, ready to impart his limited knowledge about the subject, which included planes, Arab terrorism, firefighters, and a movie with his personal American hero, Nicolas Cage.
Madam, September 11th was...
I know what he is talking about, Mr. Roy. I simply don't know what it has to do with the United Nations. We are passing it on our left, aren't we? I have seen pictures of it, but I don't know if they are the same building.
Satya looked over. It did indeed seem to be that building, although he couldn't be sure. Just like the photos Mrs. Sengupta had mentioned, the photos from his guidebook had shown only the front, not the rear.
Ronnie was watching him, however, and they remembered that the first rule of guiding was that you always know the answer, even when you don't. He nodded, smiling brightly.
Absolutely, madam. First-rate observation. Very united. United States.
Rebecca snorted. Satya looked at her quickly, but her face went completely blank.
I simply do not understand why he is repeating this information about the 9/11 incident so often. I understand it was a terrible thing, but I had thought it was a single location in New York. Was it everywhere?
Ronnie opened his mouth, his self-important smile neatly in place.
He himself had given many a talk on the subject, and felt ready to explain to Mrs. Sengupta the importance it had to Americans, and why, in fact, should she be interested in a slight detour to the memorial earlier than planned, dinner at the first Indian restaurant on her itinerary could be moved back an hour, as he happened to know the owner of the restaurant in question, an uncle, of course. Hence the very reasonable price for such exquisite food.
But before Ronnie had a chance, Rebecca's voice rang out.
They have some deal with the memorial. Or they think you don't get the news in other countries. For some reason, it's really important for guys like this to make sure that tourists like you really acknowledge how awful it was. They feel like it's their duty.
Satya held his breath. She was trying to guide. He would put a stop to that, or perhaps the widow would be so offended that she would request a change.
But Mrs. Sengupta looked at Rebecca for a long moment, and then nodded, dismissing the subject. She looked out on the bow and asked about another building along the river, one on the Brooklyn side.
As Satya rushed to explain how the boroughs of Manhattan worked, and Rebecca returned to her guidebook, Ronnie deflated, sinking into his folding chair and slumping down against the boat's movement. The precipitation had gotten neither better nor worse, but stayed an unmitigated drizzle, and Ronnie's face and glasses were beaded with tiny droplets.
Satya looked over at him and followed the direction of his gaze to where the Circle Line ticket sellers were enjoying a nice cup of coffee and chatting underneath the deck.
Both Sathya and Rani had taken one look up at the dull, bruised sky and recommended to the ladies that they observe the tour from inside the boat. But Mrs. Sengupta wouldn't hear of it, proclaiming proudly that she was not made of salt. The small widow seemed rather fragile, though, and Sathya fretted about her taking ill, but Rebecca had smiled in support and told her that, "Here we say sugar." Rani and Sathya had immediately contributed with a chorus of why salt was better, and with that they had ended up on the upper deck, getting spat on by the sky.
"What is that?"
Mrs. Sengupta was pointing to a large sign on the Brooklyn side of the river, which was on their opposite side now, as the boat had turned around halfway through its journey and ready to make the slow return to the dock.
There was a large sign on the shore, facing the left side of the boat, that said in proud letters, "Watchtower." Rebecca started laughing, while Rani looked momentarily puzzled, unable to see it, Sathya guessed. Sathya thought fast, wondering what lie would be the most easily swallowed about a building that he had never seen before in his life.
"Madam, it is what it says it is, a watchtower, making sure that sea vessels and things of that like are suitably safe in the water. In the northern parts of this coast, they call such things lighthouses. But here the lights are not necessary, as the city is already so well lit, as I'm sure you observed last night on first night in USA. So here they just have watchtower. For the ships."
Sathya was suddenly sweating, despite the chill. Rani was looking at him with approval for the first time that day, however, which made the stress of inventing this quick-thinking explanation worth it. Rebecca looked at Sathya with her eyes wide and her lips pursed. Sathya assumed this was her look of admiration for his prowess as a guide, and he smiled at her. Rebecca frowned and opened her mouth, then quickly closed it, looking away. The boat plowed on through the waves, and Sathya relaxed, enjoying the chilly breeze as it cooled him, soothing him, congratulating him on his first real test as a guide. He had passed, he knew, and whatever Rani had been angered by earlier, it seemed to be gone now. The rest of the day went quickly, from the pizza lunch in Midtown that Rebecca picked through, as Rani explained the importance of pizza in America, to the Statue of Liberty, which Mrs. Sengupta refused to climb, deciding she enjoyed the view outside more than she would the one from the middle, to dinner at Ronnie's uncle's restaurant, where Rani himself served them and over dal and naan, described his brief and calamitous career in the food industry. There was one fragile moment in which Mrs. Sengupta complimented the food as the best Indian food a Bangladeshi could make, and the bottom of Sathya's stomach dropped out. But Rani laughed, and no one seemed mad. Rani told Sathya and Rebecca when the widow went to the bathroom that Sathya didn't have to pretend to be Indian anymore, which was a relief in a way, because Sathya didn't know how to be Indian in the first place, even if everyone already assumed he was. By the time they delivered Mrs. Sengupta safely to her room, she was yawning widely but smiled faintly as well, which Sathya realized might be her way of showing happiness. She didn't smile much, which was perhaps to be expected of her, given she was in mourning, but she seemed to have enjoyed herself, or at least she hadn't complained. Rani had told Sathya of many a customer who had sent back food, demanded that the subways should be cleaner, and found the sights and sounds of New York subpar, asking for their money back on account of their disappointment. Sathya shivered. He thought of what Rebecca had said about changing your name at Ellis Island. You could, it seemed, walk into a building in America one thing and then out another. After all, he himself was now a newly baptized un-Bengali Bangladeshi, all over again. That night, Sathya showered, trying to ignore his deep sense of disquiet, his dread at leaving the city without knowing he had gotten word to Ravi. And Ronnie's warnings about the minibar in mind, ate three of the large candy bars he had smuggled in with him. Sathya lay on his bed and looked around, unable to stop himself from enjoying the room, so much more luxurious than his own at home, with air conditioning and heating controlled by a dial, soft, clean towels sitting in piles on the bathroom, and even a painting on the wall. The television had 100 channels, and the bed felt soft and plush. Satya had slept in many places, buses, trains, the storeroom of the boat, his desk at school. But his bedrooms had always consisted of a mattress on the floor. Often, they had not been bedrooms at all. In his grandmother's apartment, he'd just slept in a space where he would not be in the way. Now, he had a whole room to himself, not just in this hotel, but there in New York. He did not have to share a thing with anyone. Satya ate a fourth candy bar and felt calm. Perhaps not being Bangladeshi agreed with him, he thought sadly. And despite the rush from the sugar, he put his head on the pillow and went right to sleep. Chapter 20. Rebecca knew that the guide's far-fetched story about the watchtower building shouldn't have made her so angry. Why should she care if this guide was an idiot? Why should it matter if this Indian woman never learned about Jehovah's Witnesses? But it did somehow matter to her. Or at least, it mattered that Satya had lied. Rebecca had taken only one trip with a guide before in her life. It was a birthright trip to Israel, and she had loathed every minute of being controlled by a man on a bus with a microphone. She tuned him out whenever possible. But seeing Jerusalem, drinking arak, and letting an Israeli soldier slip his hand under her bra had eventually made it worth it. She had, however, done tours of individual places with a guide, and she had always appreciated those experiences. She loved feeling like she was learning something. It was what she enjoyed most about traveling. She remembered a fact about Notre Dame in Paris she had learned on one tour, that the magnificent church had been saved from destruction by Hitler's army because one soldier, an art lover, had stayed behind as the army marched on and cut the fuses to the explosives that would have rendered the building a pile of rubble. She had been repeating that story for years. Was it a lie? She hadn't thought of herself as a patriot, but something about the idea of this Indian woman getting a false image of the United States aggravated Rebecca. Why bother going anywhere if you were simply going to be deceived? Who was Satya to make up stories about the U.S.? She wasn't making up anything about Bangladesh. She barely even knew where it was. Rebecca smacked the hotel pillow. The tiny room smelled dank and musty, and she knew there must be mold behind the beige and green wallpaper. The lights of Times Square were clear through the one small window, and the water, when it had emerged from the groaning tap, had been yellow for 5 minutes until it turned clear. Shivering, she had sat naked in the bathroom waiting to take a shower. The night was clear and cool, and when they'd been out walking, she could smell the dried leaf crispness of fall in the air, but not near Times Square, where it smelled only like hot dogs and burnt pretzels and garbage. Having showered, she figured out a way to draw the blinds on the window and block out the obnoxious neon lights, but she still couldn't sleep. The blankets felt heavy on her body and she kicked them off, sweating. Rebecca didn't spend much time angry, as a rule. She avoided dwelling. But now she was angry, irritable for no real reason whatsoever, except that the guide had been wrong and hadn't cared. He had presented the lie with such an air of confidence and pride, so assured and clear, that she had almost found herself nodding along. She wouldn't stay silent next time, she resolved. She would correct Satya, at least once Ronnie was gone. She didn't want to jeopardize her position. She was already counting on that money for the next month's rent, and a new set of headshots. But once they left New York, she would assume control if it seemed that Satya was incompetently explaining America to this woman. Comforted by her decision, her body temperature returning to normal, she pulled the blankets back up and finally slept. The next few days in New York were a whirlwind for Rebecca, filled to the brim with things she had never wanted to do as their little group joined thousands of other tourists at the Empire State Building, Madame Tussaud's Wax Museum, the Brooklyn Bridge, and Central Park. They had changed the itinerary when Mrs. Sengupta shockingly had no interest in shopping. The park particularly seemed to confuse Mrs. Sengupta, which made sense to everyone but Rebecca, and so she asked about it as they sat on a wooden bench watching fat ducks become fatter off park concessions. Mrs. Sengupta explained that she had never been in a park that wasn't flat before. This amazed Rebecca, and she asked them all to explain what parks were like where they were from.
"Well, miss, there are no parks in Bangladesh, unlike India," explained Ronnie,
to which Sathya reacted by rearing back angrily. Their pretense of being Indian had been dropped, which relieved Rebecca, as she hadn't understood it in the first place.
"Excuse me, sir, but perhaps you did not experience parks, but in my experience, parks are there. Bangladesh is not such a place that there are no parks there," Sathya sputtered,
his tone respectful, but his eyes blazing. Ronnie met Sathya's gaze and frowned, but this time Sathya didn't grow subservient or humble. On the contrary, his look withered Ronnie, making him duck his head down slightly, almost as if he was ashamed. Rebecca watched them curiously. She had seen the two men clash in slight ways over the 3 days in New York, as Ronnie was unable to let go after the Circle Line tour. He clearly missed being a tour guide, everything from the way he directed the route they took to the fact that he insisted on ordering for everyone, using his most precise and descriptive English, peeking back at Mrs. Sengupta the entire time to make certain she was observing his abilities, screamed, "Guide."
"Parks in Kolkata are flat, and I have never been outside of Kolkata before."
The simplicity of Mrs. Sengupta's statement caught Rebecca off guard and interrupted Ronnie and Sathya's silent sparring match.
"I had assumed parks were flat," the widow continued. "Isn't it nicer that way?"
Ronnie and Sathya rushed to agree. "Yes, madam, highly superior." But Rebecca shook her head, considering her words carefully.
"I think it depends what you are looking for in a park, really. That is, what your philosophy is. This park was designed so that when you were inside of it, you wouldn't feel like you were in a city anymore. You would feel like you were in nature. I don't know if that really worked, but that's why it's hilly and so full of trees, so that you don't see the city around you. It's an escape."
"How should a park have a designer?" Sathya asked skeptically.
"This one did." Rebecca closed her eyes, searching her mind for the name. She had been told about him during her Columbia orientation.
"Olmsted. Frederick Law Olmsted."
"I have never heard of this man," said Ronnie, frowning.
Rebecca thumbed through the pages of her guidebook and showed Ronnie and Sathya the section on the park. As they looked over it, their heads bowed together. Rebecca wondered if she had made a mistake, upstaging them. But when Ronnie's face lifted from the page, it was bright with determined happiness.
"You see, nothing but the best for you, Mrs. Sengupta. Even companion is a kind of guide."
"It is an interesting idea, designing a park. I wonder if people do this in India. I did not know that this was something a person could do with their lives. As old as I am, I did not know this."
Ronnie and Sathya instantly jumped in with another chorus of denials that Mrs. Sengupta was old. But Mrs. Sengupta seemed uninterested in their token protests, however, and she continued looking out at the park as two ducks fought for a particularly large chunk of bread floating through the murky pond. She seemed content to simply sit and observe the world around her. Over the past 3 days, Rebecca had accumulated more than a few questions about the widow. Was Mrs. Sengupta usually such a passive observer? If so, why had she decided to take this trip, to be so confronted by so many unfamiliar and unknown things? In the face of her tragedy, instead of sinking into what she knew, she had come into a new and strange place where the parks were hilly. One of the ducks had waddled out of the water and was now begging for scraps up on the walkway, looking at Mrs. Sengupta expectantly. The widow smiled and shook her head at the animal. "Always on the lookout," the widow said. "Greedy things." But she spoke with a fondness. The park loomed around them, a vast forest in the city. Mrs. Sengupta seemed more at ease now, in this park that wasn't flat. Rebecca resolved to ask Mrs. Sengupta more about herself as soon as they were free from Ronnie's watchful eye. Ronnie had explained to Rebecca in rather severe terms that Indian women did not like to talk about themselves because it was immodest and un-Hindu. Rebecca, however, couldn't believe there was anyone in the world who didn't like to talk about themselves. After all, Ronnie himself was now declaiming once again about his experience of New York City, explaining that now that Mrs. Sengupta had seen everything of value there, they should be ready to depart for Niagara Falls first thing in the morning. If, of course, she was still tired from her flight, the van procured for the purpose and driven by Saurish, a very good friend and very reliable driver, would be a very comfortable place to sleep on the 8-hour trip. Mrs. Sengupta nodded and declared herself rather tired at this very moment, in fact, and could they skip dinner that night at yet another Curry Hill establishment? Ronnie looked deeply saddened by this prospect and tried to convince the widow that she really ought not to miss this particular dal, despite the fact that they had eaten dal at the majority of their meals so far. Mrs. Sengupta was not one to be persuaded of anything, Rebecca understood, as she watched the woman smile politely and patently ignore each of Ronnie's justifications, maintaining that she would really prefer room service, despite her acknowledgement that this was not, in fact, included in the price of the tour. Once Ronnie had made sure that she did indeed understand this salient point at least 5 times, he shrugged, still baffled that she would choose to pay for an extra meal. At this point, Mrs. Sengupta gently suggested that perhaps this meal should not go to waste, and nothing would please her more than Ronnie and Satya and Rebecca's enjoying the meal themselves. Rebecca quickly excused herself, and then pointed out that the loss of 2 dinner guests meant that the men would receive twice as much food, an idea that deeply intrigued both of them. After a few half-hearted protests, Ronnie and Satya agreed. Sitting in her hotel room later, having been abandoned by the men as they pursued their Curry Hill bounty, Rebecca wondered if Mrs. Sengupta was content with room service, whose menu Rebecca disdained as overpriced and bland. Maybe she might like to try something new? The idea had only just formed in Rebecca's head when she found herself knocking on the door next to hers, surprising herself with her own eagerness. Mrs. Sengupta answered the door in her pajamas, a sort of loose tunic that reached her knees, with slits up the sides almost to the waist, and soft-looking billowy trousers. Her graying hair, usually confined to a neat bun, hung in a long braid almost to her hip. She looked inquiringly at Rebecca, who smiled nervously back. "I was thinking of opting for takeout instead of room service. Would you like to join me?" "Opting for?" Rebecca smiled. As excellent as the widow's English was, Rebecca had found quickly that colloquialisms were totally lost on her in any form. Mrs. Sengupta spoke like someone from a book, one from the 1950s, perhaps, with a formal precision that amused Rebecca. Satya and Ronnie peppered their speech with Americanisms and short, overused phrases, but though Mrs. Sengupta's English was clearly more fluent, her expressions were slightly dated. "I'm choosing to get some food delivered," Rebecca rephrased. Mrs. Sengupta nodded and Rebecca realized the room service menu was in her hand. Oh, have you already ordered?
Mrs. Sengupta shook her head slightly.
No, not yet. I had just been observing my opportunities. They seem limited. I do not eat meat of any kind, which seems to be a rarity here. Almost all these dishes include some degree of flesh.
Rebecca nodded.
Have you ever had Thai food? It's an excellent choice for vegetarians.
It also had a variety of curries and rice dishes, thought Rebecca, which might ease Mrs. Sengupta into non-Indian options slowly and comfortably.
Mrs. Sengupta wiggled her head from side to side, confusing Rebecca. She had seen, in the last 3 days, each of the other members of the group employ this head-wiggling motion, but she couldn't tell what it meant. As far as she had understood, it could mean anything, or nothing.
I have eaten Thai food twice. There is one excellent place in Kolkata, and I finished my shopping early on 2 occasions and indulged in lunch alone. It was very nice. I would like to join you, if you do not mind. Please order for me. I enjoy many things. No meat or fish or eggs, please.
Rebecca had turned away to order when she heard the widow clearing her throat. She turned back. Mrs. Sengupta seemed almost shy, but the widow opened her mouth again to speak with determination.
Would you eat with me, please? I have had Thai food only alone. It would be a nice change to share it with you.
30 minutes later, sitting on a chair in Mrs. Sengupta's suite, Rebecca opened up a steaming plastic container of red curry with tofu and offered it to Mrs. Sengupta, who sniffed the fragrant steam with delight. Rebecca also opened a small packet of vegetable spring rolls and set them on a paper plate along with their sweet, sticky sauce. And finally, she unveiled her own entree, a heaping mound of vegetarian pad thai. Mrs. Sengupta seemed about to protest as Rebecca offered her this, too, so Rebecca quickly explained.
I thought we could share. This way you can try more dishes if you like. I requested that everything was meat and egg-free, and...
Oh! Rebecca broke off, standing quickly and making for the door.
Where are you going?
I have something else to add.
Rebecca left the room and returned a few minutes later with a bottle of wine in her hands.
Here. It's white, so it goes perfectly with Thai food. I know I should switch to red with the fall, but I'm not quite ready to make that transition yet. I'll grab the glasses from the bathroom. Did you try it yet? I hope it's good.
Rebecca spoke nonstop as she collected 2 glasses, unscrewed the bottle, internally congratulating herself on picking a screw top, and poured a healthy measure for both herself and Mrs. Sengupta before opening a small white rice box. Mrs. Sengupta looked at the glass as if it were a snake that might bite her.
I have never had alcohol before.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had thought that was Muslims. I didn't know that.
What was Muslims?
Muslims have a religious law against drinking, don't they?
Mrs. Sengupta nodded.
I didn't know that Hindus did too.
We don't. Not formally. My husband drank. It's only that women aren't supposed to drink. There are women who drink, but it's bad.
Really?
Yes, very bad those women are.
Rebecca smiled.
That must make me a terrible woman, then.
She raised her glass and tipped it at Mrs. Sengupta and took a swallow of her wine.
Have you drunk with others?
Rebecca could have sworn that the woman looked eager.
I don't understand.
That is, do you drink with men?
Sometimes, if they pay, Rebecca joked.
Of course, things are so different here.
Rebecca noticed that Mrs. Sengupta was not smiling as she said this.
Does that apply to everyone in India?
Rebecca asked.
I don't know. Everyone I know, at least. But I don't know so many people.
I'm sorry. You don't have to drink it, of course. I'm happy to have yours.
Mrs. Sengupta looked at her glass and wiggled her head slowly.
I hope you don't think less of me because I'm having wine. I was just kidding before. I'm not bad. At least, I don't think so.
Mrs. Sengupta wiggled her head again. Rebecca sighed internally and twirled noodles around her fork. She wasn't sure what to make of this conversation. Perhaps Mrs. Sengupta did think less of her now. Who could tell with that gesture? And really, did it even matter? Would she be less fit as a companion now in Mrs. Sengupta's eyes? Rebecca had no sense of alcohol as a moral issue. She had never been one for addiction of any kind except, apparently, to failure.
This is very nice.
Rebecca looked up to see Mrs. Sengupta enjoying the tofu with a small forkful of white rice. Rebecca smiled.
I'm glad you like it. It makes a nice change, doesn't it?
All of this is a change. It is very nice to change sometimes.
Mrs. Sengupta wrinkled her brow in determination and lifted her glass. Rebecca watched amazed as the widow took a small sip of her wine. Her face stayed wrinkled, and she handed the glass to Rebecca.
This is not for me. Still, I thank you. A nice change.
Rebecca smiled and added the portion of wine to her own glass.
You are not a terrible woman, Mrs. Sengupta told her seriously, and took a bite of the curried tofu, her eyes closing in delight.
Thank you,
Rebecca said, equally seriously.
As she watched, the widow savored each bite like it was the finest meal she had ever had. Perhaps it was.
Chapter 21
The trip to Niagara Falls had been a good idea, Pival thought, as she stared into the mountain of water gushing toward her. She hadn't thought that it could have been worth the arduous drive, but it was. Every bump in the road and stall in the traffic had felt like torture. But now, seeing the massive falls pour their sheets and sheets of water so close to her that she could feel the spray, she knew it was only the torture that comes before joy. It had been a pilgrimage, she realized, thinking of her shrine at home, and now she was seeing the divinity in store for her. Astounding rainbows exploded off the edges of the waterfall. When Pival closed her eyes, she could almost feel their colors on her face. Her body encased in a bright blue plastic poncho, she leaned off the edge of the deck into the spray of the falls, trying to crane her body as close to the water as possible. Around her, a surprising number of Indians jostled with each other for space on the deck, pushing and shoving and muttering rude comments as their phones and cameras rose above the crowd, snapping a never-ending series of photos of the same exact view. Just like home, Pival thought, watching her countrymen elbow each other out of the way and berate each other for their rudeness.
Are there many Indians here?
She asked Satya, who looked startled at the question.
There are Indians everywhere, Rebecca said, adjusting her slicker so it would cover her hair completely.
Pival wondered if that was really true. Certainly everyone she knew at home had sent someone to America, but they usually came back. Where had all these people come from? What was life here like for them? Had Rahi been here? Had he seen the falls crashing on and on and on? Amid the crowd, one man took his small son, Pival judged him at 3 or 4, and raised the boy over the water, dangling him off the side of the boat, and the child kicked and squealed with delight, making his dangerous position even more precarious. Pival gasped in horror at the man's tenuous grip on the wildly bucking child,
The man was thin and reedy, struggling under the weight of the boy, and the more the child's body squirmed, the more likely it seemed that he would be dropped into the cold and fast-moving waters below. One of the attendants who had outfitted them with slickers and warned them about the water was blowing a whistle, and next to her, Rebecca and Satya seemed not to notice.